Chapter 25. The Boy. It's only in hindsight that I'm able to appreciate just how high my star had risen. I'd gone from being the student who couldn't speak in class to being the teacher of the language of a new age, from the child of modest middle-class beltway parents to the man living the island life and making so much money that it had lost its meaning. In just the 7 short years of my career, I'd climbed from maintaining local servers to crafting and implementing globally deployed systems, from graveyard shift security guard to keymaster of the puzzle palace. But there's always a danger in letting even the most qualified person rise too far, too fast, before they've had enough time to get cynical and abandon their idealism. I occupied one of the most unexpectedly omniscient positions in the intelligence community, toward the bottom rung of the managerial ladder, but high atop heaven in terms of access. And while this gave me phenomenal and frankly undeserved ability to observe the IC in its grim fullness, it also left me more curious than ever about the one fact I was still finding elusive, the absolute limit of who the agency could turn its gaze against. It was a limit set less in policy or law than in the ruthless, unyielding capabilities of what I now knew to be a world-spanning machine. Was there anyone this machine could not surveil? Was there anywhere this machine could not go? The only way to discover the answer was to descend, abandoning my panoptic perch for the narrow vision of an operational role. The NSA employees with the freest access to the rawest forms of intelligence were those who sat in the operator's chair and typed into their computers the names of the individuals who'd fallen under suspicion, foreigners and U.S. citizens alike. For one reason or another, or for no reason at all, these individuals had become targets of the agency's closest scrutiny, with the NSA interested in finding out everything about them and their communications. My ultimate destination, I knew, was the exact point of this interface, the exact point where the state cast its eye on the human and the human remained unaware. The program that enables this access was called X-Keyscore, which is perhaps best understood as a search engine that lets an analyst search through all the records of your life. Imagine a kind of Google that, instead of showing pages from the public internet, returns results from your private email, your private chats, your private files, everything. Though I'd read through enough about the program to understand how it worked, I hadn't yet used it, and I realized I ought to know more about it. By pursuing X-Keyscore, I was looking for a personal confirmation of the depths of the NSA's surveillance intrusions, the kind of confirmation you don't get from documents, but only from direct experience. One of the few offices in Hawaii with truly unfettered access to X-Keyscore was the National Threat Operations Center. NTOC worked out of the sparkling but soulless new open-plan office the NSA had formerly named the Rochefort Building, after Joseph Rochefort, a legendary World War II-era naval cryptanalyst who broke Japanese codes. Most employees had taken to calling it the Roach Fort, or simply the Roach. At the time I applied for a job there, parts of the Roach were still under construction, and I was immediately reminded of my first cleared job with Castle. It was my fate to begin and end my IC career in unfinished buildings. In addition to housing almost all of the agency's Hawaii-based translators and analysts, the Roach also accommodated the local branch of the Tailored Access Operations, TAO, division. This was the NSA unit responsible for remotely hacking into the computers of people whom analysts had selected as targets, the agency's equivalent of the old burglary teams that once snuck into enemies' homes to plant bugs and find compromising material. NTOC's main job, by contrast, was to monitor and frustrate the activity of the TAO's foreign equivalents. As luck would have it, NTOC had a position open through a contractor at Booz Allen Hamilton, a job they euphemistically described as infrastructure analyst. The role involved using the complete spectrum of the NSA's mass surveillance tools, including X-Keyscore, to monitor activity on the infrastructure of interest, the internet. Though I'd be making slightly more money at Booz, around $120,000 a year, I considered it a demotion, the first of many, as I began my final descent, jettisoning my access, my clearances, and my agency privileges. I was an engineer who was becoming an analyst who would ultimately become an exile, a target of the very technologies I'd once controlled. From that perspective, this particular fall in prestige seemed pretty minor. From that perspective, everything seemed pretty minor, as the arc of my life bent back toward Earth, accelerating toward the point of impact that would end my career, my relationship, my freedom, and possibly my life. I decided to bring my archives out of the country and pass them to the journalists I'd contacted, but before I could even begin to contemplate the logistics of that act, I had to go shake some hands. I had to fly east to D.C. and spend a few weeks meeting and greeting my new bosses and colleagues who had high hopes for how they might apply my keen understanding of online anonymization to unmask their more clever targets. This was what brought me back to the Beltway for the very last time, and back to the site of my first encounter with an institution that had lost control, Fort Meade. This time, I was arriving as an insider. The day that marked my coming of age, just over 10 tumultuous years earlier, had profoundly changed not just the people who worked at NSA headquarters, but the place itself. I first noticed this fact when I got stopped in my rental car trying to turn off K-9 Road into one of the agency's parking lots, which in my memory still howled with panic, ringtones, car horns, and sirens. Since 9/11, all the roads that led to NSA headquarters had been permanently closed to anyone who didn't possess one of the special IC badges now hanging around my neck. Whenever I wasn't glad-handing NTOC leadership at headquarters, I spent my time learning everything I could, hot-desking with analysts who worked different programs and different types of targets, so as to be able to teach my fellow team members back in Hawaii the newest ways the agency's tools might be used. That, at least, was the official explanation of my curiosity, which, as always, exceeded the requirements and earned the gratitude of the technologically inclined. They, in turn, were as eager as ever to demonstrate the power of the machinery they'd developed without expressing a single qualm about how that power was applied. While at headquarters, I was put through a series of tests on the proper use of the system, which were more like regulatory compliance exercises or procedural shields than meaningful instruction. The other analysts told me that since I could take these tests as many times as I had to, I shouldn't bother learning the rules. Just click the boxes until you pass. The NSA described X-Key score in the documents I'd later pass on to journalists as its widest-ranging tool used to search nearly everything a user does on the internet. The technical specs I studied went into more detail as to how exactly this was accomplished, by packetizing and sessionizing, or cutting up the data of a user's online sessions into manageable packets for analysis. But nothing could prepare me for seeing it in action. It was, simply put, the closest thing to science fiction I've ever seen in science fact. An interface that allows you to type in pretty much anyone's address, telephone number, or IP address, and then basically go through the recent history of their online activity. In some cases, you could even play back recordings of their online sessions so that the screen you'd be looking at was their screen, whatever was on their desktop. You could read their emails, their browser history, their search history, their social media postings, everything. You could set up notifications that would pop up when some person or some device you were interested in became active on the internet for the day. And you could look through the packets of internet data to see a person's search queries appear letter by letter, since so many sites transmitted each character as it was typed. It was like watching an autocomplete as letters and words flashed across the screen. But the intelligence behind that typing wasn't artificial, but human. This was a human complete. My weeks at Fort Meade and the short stint I put in at Booz back in Hawaii were the only times I saw firsthand the abuses actually being committed that I'd previously read about in internal documentation. Seeing them made me realize how insulated my position at the systems level had been from the ground zero of immediate damage. I could only imagine the level of insulation of the agency's directorship, or for that matter, of the U.S. president. I didn't type the names of the agency director or the president into X-Keyscore, but after enough time with the system, I realized I could have. Everyone's communications were in the system. Everyone's. I was initially fearful that if I searched those in the uppermost echelons of state, I'd be caught and fired, or worse. But it was surpassingly simple to disguise a query regarding even the most prominent figure by encoding my search terms in a machine format that looked like gibberish to humans, but would be perfectly understandable to X-Keyscore. If any of the auditors who were responsible for reviewing the searches ever bothered to look more closely, they would see only a snippet of obfuscated code, while I would be able to scroll through the most personal activities of a Supreme Court justice or a congressperson. As far as I could tell, none of my new colleagues intended to abuse their powers so grandly, although if they had, it's not like they'd ever mention it. Anyway, when analysts thought about abusing the system, they were far less interested in what it could do for them professionally than in what it could do for them personally. This led to the practice known as LoveInt, a gross joke on HumeInt and SigInt, and a travesty of intelligence, in which analysts use the agency's programs to surveil their current and former lovers, along with objects of more casual affection, reading their emails, listening in on their phone calls, and stalking them online. NSA employees knew that only the dumbest analysts were ever caught red-handed, and though the law stated that anyone engaging in any type of surveillance for personal use could be locked up for at least a decade, no one in the agency's history had been sentenced to even a day in prison for the crime. Analysts understood that the government would never publicly prosecute them, because you can't exactly convict someone of abusing your secret system of mass surveillance if you refuse to admit the existence of the system itself. The obvious costs of such a policy became apparent to me as I sat along the back wall of Vault V-22 at NSA headquarters with two of the more talented infrastructure analysts, whose workspace was decorated with a 7-foot-tall picture of Star Wars famous Wookiee Chewbacca. I realized, as one of them was explaining to me the details of his target's security routines, that intercepted nudes were a kind of informal office currency, because his buddy kept spinning in his chair to interrupt us with a smile saying, "Check her out," to which my instructor would invariably reply, "Bonus," or "Nice." The unspoken transactional rule seemed to be that if you found a naked photo or video of an attractive target, or someone in communication with the target, you had to show the rest of the boys, at least as long as there weren't any women around. That was how you knew you could trust each other. You had shared one another's crimes. One thing you come to understand very quickly while using X-Keyscore is that nearly everyone in the world who's online has at least two things in common. They have all watched porn at one time or another, and they all store photos and videos of their family. This was true for virtually everyone of every gender, ethnicity, race, and age, from the meanest terrorist to the nicest senior citizen, who might be the meanest terrorist's grandparent or parent or cousin. It's the family stuff that got to me the most. I remember this one child in particular, a little boy in Indonesia. Technically, I shouldn't have been interested in this little boy, but I was, because my employers were interested in his father. I had been reading through the shared targeting folders of a persona analyst, meaning someone who typically spent most of their day sifting through artifacts like chat logs and Gmail inboxes and Facebook messages, rather than the more obscure and difficult, typically hacker-generated traffic of the infrastructure analysts. The boy's father, like my own, was an engineer. But unlike my father, this guy wasn't government or military affiliated. He was just a regular academic who'd been caught up in a surveillance dragnet. I can't even remember how or why he'd come to the agency's attention beyond sending a job application to a research university in Iran. The grounds for suspicion were often poorly documented, if they were documented at all, and the connections could be incredibly tenuous, believed to be potentially associated with, and then the name of some international organization that could be anything from a telecommunications standards body to UNICEF to something you might actually agree is menacing. Selections from the man's communications had been sieved out of the stream of internet traffic and assembled into folders. Here was the fatal copy of the resume sent to the suspect university. Here were his texts. Here was his web browser history. Here was the last week or so of his correspondence, both sent and received, tagged to the IP addresses. Here were the coordinates of a geofence the analyst had placed around him to track whether he strayed too far from home, or perhaps traveled to the university for his interview. Then there were his pictures and a video. He was sitting in front of his computer, as I was sitting in front of mine, except that in his lap, he had a toddler, a boy in a diaper. The father was trying to read something, but the kid kept shifting around, smacking the keys and giggling. The computer's internal mic picked up his giggling. And there I was, listening to it on my headphones. The father held the boy tighter, and the boy straightened up, and with his dark crescent eyes, looked directly into the computer's camera. I couldn't escape the feeling that he was looking directly at me. Suddenly, I realized that I'd been holding my breath. I shut the session, got up from the computer, and left the office for the bathroom in the hall, head down, headphones still on with the cord trailing. Everything about that kid, everything about his father, reminded me of my own father, whom I met for dinner one evening during my stint at Fort Meade. I hadn't seen him in a while, but there, in the midst of dinner, over bites of Caesar salad and a pink lemonade, I had the thought, I'll never see my family again. My eyes were dry. I was exerting as much control as I could, but inside I was devastated. I knew that if I told him what I was about to do, he would have called the cops, or else he would have called me crazy and had me committed to a mental hospital. He would have done anything he thought he had to do to prevent me from making the gravest of mistakes. I could only hope that his hurt would in time be healed by pride. Back in Hawaii, between March and May 2013, a sense of finality suffused nearly every experience for me, and though the experiences themselves might seem trivial, they eased my path. It was far less painful to think that this was the last time I'd ever stop at the Curry Place in Mililani, or drop by the art gallery hacker space in Honolulu, or just sit on the roof of my car and scan the nighttime sky for falling stars, than to think that I only had another month left with Lindsay, or another week left of sleeping next to her and waking up next to her, and yet trying to keep my distance from her, for fear of breaking down. The preparations I was making were those of a man about to die. I emptied my bank accounts, putting cash into an old steel ammo box for Lindsay to find so that the government couldn't seize it. I went around the house doing oft-procrastinated chores like fixing windows and changing light bulbs. I erased and encrypted my old computers, reducing them to the silent husks of better times. In sum, I was putting my affairs in order to try to make everything easier for Lindsay. Or just for my conscience, which periodically would switch allegiance from a world that hadn't earned it to the woman who had, and the family I loved. Everything was imbued with this sense of an ending, and yet there were moments when it seemed that no end was in sight and that the plan I'd developed was collapsing. It was difficult to get the journalists to commit to a meeting, mostly because I couldn't tell them who they were meeting with, or even, for a while at least, where and when it was happening. I had to reckon with the prospect of them never showing up, or of them showing up but then dropping out. Ultimately, I decided that if either of those happened, I'd just abandon the plan and return to work and to Lindsay as if everything was normal, to wait for my next chance. In my war drives back and forth from Cunia, a 20-minute ride that would become a 2-hour Wi-Fi scavenger hunt, I'd been researching various countries, trying to find a location for my meeting with the journalists. It felt like I was picking out my prison, or rather my grave. All of the Five Eyes countries were obviously off limits. In fact, all of Europe was out, because its countries couldn't be counted upon to uphold international law against the extradition of those charged with political crimes in the face of what was sure to be significant American pressure. Africa and Latin America were no-go zones, too. The United States had a history of acting there with impunity. Russia was out because it was Russia, and China was China. Both were totally out of bounds. The U.S. government wouldn't have to do anything to discredit me other than point at the map. The optics would be worse in the Middle East. It sometimes seemed as if the most challenging hack of my life wasn't going to be plundering the NSA, but rather trying to find a meeting venue independent enough to hold off the White House and free enough to not interfere with my activities. The process of elimination left me with Hong Kong. In geopolitical terms, it was the closest I could get to no man's land, but with a vibrant media and protest culture, not to mention largely unfiltered internet. It was an oddity, a reasonably liberal world city whose nominal autonomy would distance me from China and restrain Beijing's ability to take public action against me or the journalists, at least immediately, but whose de facto existence in Beijing's sphere of influence would also reduce the possibility of unilateral U.S. intervention. In a situation with no promise of safety, it was enough to have the guarantee of time. Chances were that things weren't going to end well for me anyway. The best I could hope for was getting the disclosures out before I was caught. The last morning I woke up with Lindsay, she was leaving on a camping trip to Kauai, a brief getaway with friends that I'd encouraged. We lay in bed, and I held her too tightly. And when she asked with sleepy bewilderment why I was suddenly being so affectionate, I apologized. I told her how sorry I was for how busy I'd been, and that I was going to miss her. She was the best person I'd ever met in my life. She smiled, pecked me on the cheek, and then got up to pack. The moment she was out the door, I started crying, for the first time in years. I felt guilty about everything except what my government would accuse me of, and especially guilty about my tears, because I knew that my pain would be nothing compared to the pain I'd caused to the woman I loved, or to the hurt and confusion I'd caused my family. At least I had the benefit of knowing what was coming. Lindsay would return from her camping trip to find me gone, ostensibly on a work assignment, and my mother basically waiting on our doorstep. I'd invited my mother to visit, in a move so uncharacteristic that she must have expected another type of surprise, like an announcement that Lindsay and I were engaged. I felt horrible about the false pretenses and winced at the thought of her disappointment. But I kept telling myself I was justified. My mother would take care of Lindsay, and Lindsay would take care of her. Each would need the other's strength to weather the coming storm. The day after Lindsay left, I took an emergency medical leave of absence from work, citing epilepsy, and packed scant luggage and 4 laptops, secure communications, normal communications, a decoy, and an air gap, a computer that had never gone and would never go online. I left my smartphone on the kitchen counter alongside a notepad on which I scribbled in pen, "Got called away for work. I love you." I signed it with my call letter nickname, Echo. Then I went to the airport and bought a ticket in cash for the next flight to Tokyo. In Tokyo, I bought another ticket in cash and on May 20th, arrived in Hong Kong, the city where the world first met me.